If you read through an early New England catechism, you may find this couplet, "How odd that God, the Jews, should choose." In their innocent arrogance, the writers believed that they would have chosen far more appropriate bearers for God's message and teaching. It might have surprised these Yankees to know that 2,000 years earlier, the rabbis had puzzled the same oddity. How was it that among all the mighty empires of the world, that our fathers were chosen to be the bearers of God's light? The rabbis answered, "It was precisely because we were the least. God did not wish his laws of truth and peace to be imposed by the sword. A mighty nation may impose its will, but the laws of gentleness and kindness are subverted as they are imposed." So let's reverse the jingle. How odd the Jews, one God, should choose. How was it that our fathers came to the vision of the one, all-embracing spiritual power, monotheism? The belief in the one God seems to us a most natural idea. It is, after all, now shared by all the peoples of Western civilization and is embodied in the teachings of the great faiths of the West. Our science demands some such unitary explanation of the universe. Our science insists there are simple, overarching laws which bind all nature together, that there is some single force of energy by which the universe is bound as one. Monotheism seems to be an elemental requirement of life. It did not seem so to our ancestors. When they looked about them, the world they saw seemed to be made up of separate parts. Here was the moon moving across the night sky. Later, the sun came on a different orbit. Each star had its own individual ellipse. There was a stream that bubbled up out of a seemingly bottomless source. There was the wind, and no man knew from whence it came. Our fathers assumed that naturally, in each of the great forces of nature, there dwelt some power, a God, which directed its destiny. What was it that bound together the sun, the moon, the stars, and the brook? Precious little. Since there was no apparent similarity between them, each must be directed by its own deity. 3,000 years ago, common sense demanded a polytheistic explanation of life. How odd, then, the Jews one God should choose. What allowed our fathers to make the conceptual leap, to see that behind all the many elements of nature, there was, metaphorically, one hand and one wisdom? The answer, of course, is that we do not really know. Some explain that our people were Bedouin shepherds who lived close to the empty spaces and therefore saw clearly the unrolling cycles of nature. But then how explain that of all the Bedouins, only our fathers, the Hebrews, abandoned polytheism? How explain that they abandoned it in favor of a single creative principle? Some argue that as desert folk, we avoided the pretensions associated with the various urban gods. When one country conquered another, it destroyed its defeated gods or reduced them to a subordinate place in a new pantheon. Watching these changes, our fathers smiled to themselves and came to understand that behind all gods, there was only one. Others suggest that our fathers watched a young pharaoh, Akhenaten, destroyer of the statues in the temples of Egypt, all statues save that of his patron god, Atun. They saw Egypt's other gods, Ra, Isis, Anubis, could not protect their priests and their sanctuaries. And our fathers came to understand that there was only a single, all-powerful God, a one. Why was this lesson lost in all the other peoples of antiquity? The Bible offers a simple explanation. God had revealed his essence, his oneness, to Moses on Mount Sinai. Frankly, we have no better explanation. Somewhere in the spiritual genius which marks our people, a man, it may have been Moses, we do not know exactly, reached out with his mind into the darkness and touched the vision of the one God. Science did not demand it. Indeed, science argued against it. Reason did not demand it. Indeed, reasonable men of the day argued against it. So, how odd the Jews, one God should choose. God is, and God is one. Our fathers offered their prayers only to the one God, the unique God, the God who had created all. This is a fundamental religious postulate of our people. The Lord, he is God, and there are no other gods. No angels, no demons, no archangels, no satans, no we people of the night, no spirits which fly in the moonlight, no voices which call from the grave. Twice each day our fathers left off plowing and herding and spoke the simple watchword, Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad, the Lord, he is one. That phrase is written high above our ark, is the climactic formula of our worship, is the ultimate affirmation spoken by the Jew before he dies. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad, hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. There is a God. Life is not a chance mechanical explosion or hapless endurance contest. There is purpose and there is promise to life. God is that guarantor that it all has meaning. Life is a blessing. God is one. Sometimes people who ought to know better say that Judaism has no dogma. Those who find belief embarrassing might wish it to be so. Certainly, many find theology awkward. And certainly, we have never affirmed a catechism. We have no parallel to the Apostles' Creed or the Westminster Confession. But we do have fundamental doctrine. The Lord, he is one. Some may be shocked by our fathers' uncompromising attacks on idols and on idol worship. We live in an age of goodwill. We reach out to join with others in common enterprise. Ecumenism is our watchword. We're eager for cooperation. But in our Bible, we see people determined to obliterate the foreign gods. The high places must be torn down, stone by stone, and plowed under. The sacred groves must be cut down, and the timber used for firewood. Foreign gods were vanity, shameful, and worse. There could be no accommodation between the peoples of the one God and those who worship many gods. Our ancestors would have been surprised to hear some of their descendants argue. It matters not what you believe, so long as you believe. It matters not how you worship, so long as you worship. It didn't matter. It didn't matter if you worship the fire god Moloch, whose worship required children to pass through fire to satisfy him. Didn't matter if you offered allegiance to one of the great fertility cults of Canaan. You offered it a shrine which was scandalous for its orgiastic rites. It matters whether you offer your loyalty to the god of a master race and shout Sieg Heil. Worship of a master race leads to war, to grinding the poor and the weak under an iron boot. It does matter what you believe. Worship may be modest and high-minded, or it can be vulgar and depraved. Outrageous beliefs lead to outrageous actions. The worship of the one God permits only one war, a war against want, against injustice, against hate, and against cruelty. Belief itself is not a virtue. Belief is simply attachment to some ideal, some idea, some hope. What if you were attached to a base idea, and to a corrupt hope? Perversions, cruelty, and bloodletting can be demanded by powerful beliefs. Understanding this, you understand why our fathers were at war with all forms of idolatry. Judaism has never broken heads with people who simply would not see our particular way, or would not join in our particular liturgy. Monotheism was not a matter of theology, it was a matter of humanity. If Ra, the great god of Egypt, created man, then the Egyptians was the master race. If Marduk, the great god of the Babylonians, created man, then they were the master race. Idolatry inevitably separated men into races and into nations. Idolatry set race against race and nation against nation. It consecrated a class system. Racism thrives in the soil of idolatry. Even the greatest of pagan philosophers, Plato and Aristotle, never freed themselves of the conceits of race. To these men, the slave was a living tool, subhuman, barbarian, a lesser breed without the law. What is justice in an idolatrous world? Justice is pleasure for the well-born and the whip for the slave. What is peace in an idolatrous world? Peace must inevitably be the conquest of the people who worship gods other than yours. The idolatrous world was a fragmented world, and so only the privilege of one's own caste and beliefs. Idolatry precludes the notion of a single humanity. So our fathers warred with idolatry because it led to racism, to a society divided between free and slave. It legitimizes arrogant privileges some men enjoy at the expense of others. Idolatry destroyed man's balance, the principle of moderation. God is one, the one God who is served best by the moral life. For the polytheism, there's a God of life and a God of death. The Egyptians centered their worship on the God of death, and literally buried their national wealth between monuments and the pyramids. They put into the hand not only their mummies, but their labor, their schools, their hospitals, their roads, their irrigation projects, all that might have lifted the burden of slavery and of abjectness from the mass of their people, all that might have spurred progress. Canaan's ritual centered on an agricultural cult, the worship of the Baalim, or gods of fertility. Theirs was a myth, the great god of the sky mated each year with Mother Earth, and out of this mating came the next year's harvest. It's an impressive myth. The Baal worshippers at their shrines imitated the symbolic mating of the gods. How many shrines of antiquity became synonymous with drunken revelry? Israel viewed God as a moral being, guarantor that there is a moral principle in the universe. Israel was at war with idolatry because idolatry was at war with morality. In what does God's morality consist? I am the Lord, God of mercy, and God of righteousness. God is the ultimate principle of justice, decency, maturity, and of righteousness. So much for history. What of our own day? Men no longer raise stone shrines on hilltops or plant sacred groves for sacred dances. Men no longer make curious images to place within the holy places of the sanctuaries. We make no more idols, or do we? What are those little plastic figures on the dashboard of cars? Innocent, certainly, unless the car's driver is convinced that these deities protect when the foot is heavy on the accelerator pedal. Surely the charms you wear around your neck are only relics of a superstitious past. But are they not also signposts on the road to idolatry? What of the deity of the white skin, the racist god? What of the deities of race, of pride, of birth, and pride of place? We are scandalized that the ancients should offer human sacrifices to their gods. I put to you that each decade we offer greater sacrifice to the gods of national ambition and greed. Does not each of us have our own private set of idols? Have we not projected into the heavens a rather indulgent deity who forgives us our foibles, applauds our trivial accomplishments, and does not rebuke us for neglecting the needs of others? We no longer construct altars of stone or idols of wood. We do worship ideologies. We do at times assume that what the state demands must be granted. We've enshrined our privilege. We seek divine reassurance that that what we have is rightfully granted to us, and what another lacks is simply his bad luck. In the year 63 before the Common Era, the Emperor Pompey marched into Jerusalem at the head of a Roman legion. He was a pagan, and an inquisitive man who had been surprised to hear that Jews worshipped an invisible god. He's convinced that the temple's Holy of Holies must have a cult object. A man of action, he brushed aside tact and taste to satisfy his curiosity. Pompey entered the Holy of Holies and found there only an empty room. Our sanctuaries are empty, and yet they are full. They are full with the knowledge of the one God who is the God of all. The God we know is in and of, and yet beyond the spiritual underpinning of the universe. We've never put images in our Holy of Holies. Many of us have put images in our private sanctuaries. The rabbis asked, why is it that only one man, Adam, was created? They answered that none might say, my answer was created first, and I have a first claim on God. They also answered that none might say, my answer was created a free man, and your answers are created only to be slaves, mine to rule, yours to obey. Why was only one man created? That all should be able to say, that man is my brother. There is the same law, one law for the stranger and the homeborn. I must be as considerate with those of other groups as I am with my own. My responsibilities extend as widely as do God's. There is only one creator, one creation, one humanity, and one moral law. Thank God, the Jews, one God did choose. Amen.